You're all very welcome to today's podcast. I am here in Princeton and I'm joined by Professor Philip Pettit, and we are going to be discussing the work of Thomas Hobbes. So thank you very much for taking part in the podcast today.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
So I'm just going to give a little bit of background about your work and your achievements, if that's okay. So I'm going to run through a little list of your various accolades. So at the moment, you are the L.S. Rockefeller Professor of Human Values here at Princeton, as well as a Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Australian National University. You hold many honorary professorships. You are also a Fellow of the American Academy of Art and Science. You are a member of the Royal Irish Academy, the British Academy, and the Academy of Social Science in Australia, as well as, most recently, a Companion of the Order of Australia in the 2017 Queen's Birthday Honours. Next year, in 2019, you'll be presenting the Locke Lectures at Oxford University. You have authored over a dozen books, and you work in moral and political theory, philosophy, civic republicanism, freedom, ethics, and in particular your book, Republicanism, A Theory of Freedom and Government, provided the underlying justification for political reform in Spain under Zapatero. I mean, that's a pretty phenomenal list of accolades, and you're a proud Irishman to boot.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you entered into the field of philosophy yourself?
Oh, by accident, actually. I went to, when I was to go to university, I decided to train for the priesthood, and so I went to Maynooth College. In those days, I suppose it's still the same. If you went to the seminary in Maynooth, you were automatically also registered at the National University of Ireland. Same campus, the seminary and the National University. As is still the case, I guess, though there's more of a divide now. In those days, of course, there weren't any university students other than seminarians in Maynooth. But I went there and I didn't know what to do. My choice was really between classics, which was then still very popular in Irish schools back in the 60s, Greek and Latin, and maths, which I rather liked. And I opted for classics and then decided against in my first year. And the other subject I was doing was a mathematical logic, because somebody said, if you're good at maths, you'll have no problem mathematical logic. And I began looking around, what did I want to do? And I looked at all sorts of subjects and what they were doing, what I could change to. And then somebody told me about philosophy, and they said, well, you know, you think about whether people, whether they've got free will, you know, what value is, whether there's a God, how you argue for or against God. And I thought, wow, that's what I want to do. And I changed there and then, and I went on and did philosophy for my BA in Maynooth. And I then did an MA on leave, so to speak, from the seminary for a year. And I left the seminary at the end of that with an MA in philosophy. And those were wonderful years where jobs were readily available in universities. So I think within a week I was teaching at Queen's University in Belfast. And then I moved a year later to UCD in Dublin, where I taught for a number of years before joining the exile.
Very good. And how long have you been in Princeton?
I was in Australia for a long period, between 83 and 70 and 2002. And then I moved full-time to Princeton in 2002. I was here for 12 years. And then in 2012, I made this current arrangement I have happily with Princeton and with the Australian National University in Canberra, whereby I spend half the year in each.
That's fantastic. I mean, just amazing to be part of such two great institutions, but to be able to have those two audiences, I suppose, as well, in terms of like your research and your work and being able to engage in those two societies, I guess, gives you two totally different
students
perspectives.
Students and colleagues. I mean, I also keep very close touch with Ireland, people in Ireland, and get back there at least once every year.
Can I ask about your work with the Zapatero and how, I mean, of course, academics are putting their ideas out constantly through articles, through conferences, and through books. How do you get into a situation where you're influencing actual change within policy, within government, within institutional reform?
I'd have to say probably a total fluke, really. I had written this book in 1997, which I called Republicanism, A Theory of Freedom and Government. And it was part of a philosophical attempt to rethink the long Republican tradition that goes back to Rome, you know, goes through the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, down to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and indeed the Irish Revolution of 1798, and then really goes underground. At least that's my way of viewing it. And, you know, I work closely with historians like Quentin Skinner on the historical aspect of the project. But that book reconstructed what I see still as the main principles of a Republican political philosophy, which you get the elements of in Wolfe Tone, for example, in the 1790s. And I wrote actually in preface of that book that, look, this is just a little rivulet, a little tributary into the large river, you know, of political and conversation, you know, and I'm sure it won't have much impact and so on. But it's important that we, you know, make our own individual efforts, which I strongly believe. And it was just fluke that Zapatero became head of the Labour Party, the Socialist Party, in 2000 in Spain. And as I learned later from his advisors, he wanted to have a philosophy that would back his policies rather than making up the policies as he goes along. And he read very, very widely. And apparently my book had just been translated into Spanish in 1999. He came across my book. And then over the following 4 years, he referred to the book and referred to me quite often in Spain. So friends in Spain would write to me and say, you know, there was an editorial using your name in such and such a newspaper, or Zapatero was doing it. And to me, I was charming, but, you know, I wasn't involved directly. But then he invited me to a meeting of the Socialist Party, the annual, the year before he won government, and I couldn't go. I was committed to another conference. I was really sad about that. But then he got government in March 2004, and he already brought in some policies relating them to the book. The first policy, actually, was one whereby he made the broadcaster independent of the government, which it hadn't been really in Spain, so that it could be a critic of the government. And then he invited me to give a public lecture in Madrid, which he was to reply in 2004. That was in July 2004, 3 months after he was elected. And I gave that lecture in Madrid with him and various people in the party, and, you know, the press and so on there. And in the course of it, I jokingly said to him, you know, it's wonderful, it's very easy to be a philosopher like me. You know, you think about these things in the armchair, you know. Mm. You read your books, but that's it. It's very difficult to be a statesperson or a politician like you. And I said, for example, you know, it was easy for me to defend and provide arguments for why you should have an independent public broadcaster as well as private broadcasters. And I'm delighted you brought in that policy, but you're going to find it very hard to live up to it, because 2 years' time, you'll probably find the national broadcaster is your worst critic. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find it really tempting to pick up the phone and tell them, you know, you depend on me, that I'm the one who gave you this independence. You should be more grateful. And he was very exercised about that. And in his reply, rather than going through what he had written as his reply to my lecture, he invited me publicly to review his government for how faithful it had been to Republican principles, as I interpreted
that's,
them.
That's incredible. Like, that's incredibly
brave.
I mean, how rare would that be, that any government would ask somebody to come in and critique and
their
find
policies? Yes.
That's, I mean, on the basis of, do you think that that's something that should happen in general? That there should be a kind of a means for reviewing and holding governments to account for?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a good government should, or do you think that should be?
Well, I, you know, there's a book I wrote with a Spanish lawyer, become philosopher, some years later, a book on the republicanism in Spain, civic republicanism in Zapatero, Spain. And thinking about that, I must say, I became convinced, really, I mean, he was very impressive. Mm-hmm. And the reason he invited me to do this 6 months before the next election was that he wanted to show that he was absolutely committed. You know, this was like a pre-commitment. You know, he was going to suffer if he didn't, so to speak, because I would give him, obviously, a very bad review. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a philosopher to be asked to review government of, you know, the ninth largest economy in the world, and maybe I think it was the eighth or seventh at the time, actually, was extraordinary. And, of course, I really did not feel like doing that sort of thing, you know.
You had really negative things to say?
But it wasn't what I wanted to spend 3 years doing, you know. Yes. I had other projects on and so on. I mean, I'm a philosopher rather than a political scientist or advisor. And I had to agree, really. Mm-hmm. And someone stood up in the audience ahead of some foundation and said, we will support, you know, Professor Pella's research or whatever he needs, you know, his visit to Spain to give this. And the one good thing about it was he had asked me, I'd met him just before going in to give the lecture, and he had asked me, would I be an advisor to him? And that really struck me, because, I really don't think philosophers should be in the business of giving advice to government. Mm-hmm. I mean, they should be part maybe of a committee, because all policy depends on principles that philosophers might be able to talk about, but it also depends on facts on the ground, you know, empirical stuff that sociology, economics, political science has to contribute. But at least I could say to him afterwards, I said, now that I accepted being, so to speak, an umpire, you know, of your performance, I can't be an advisor. I was very glad to get out of that role, actually. People sometimes say I was an advisor, but I wasn't ever an advisor. I was like an arbiter, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
And then I gave the lecture in 2007. And that was he was wonderful in those years. Mm. Once the financial crisis came, I think he felt really out of his depth, because he didn't have a great grasp, I would have said, of the economic problems, and was convinced they were passing and they would go away, refused to call them a crisis, very bad politics, you know. Mm-hmm. Everyone said, call it a crisis, you know, because it got worse and worse. He did get re-elected, but his second term in government was really just holding the fort. Whereas the first term, he brings in all sorts of innovative policies. And I meet him a few times over that 3 years preparing my review, and he's always intent on persuading me, you know, that he was following the book. So he was true to republicanism. And so the things he did were remarkable. It was the third legislature in the world to make gay marriage legal, homosexual marriage, as they call it in Spain. And he introduced all sorts of legislation benefiting women. He legalized the position of 750,000 illegal immigrants in Spain, and did this in a way that people were accepting of, you know.
Yes,
he was quite remarkable in those years. You know, brave. I mean, going for the gay marriage, for example, he was, after all, going against the opinion of most people in Spain by a long shot, and most people in his party. You know, it wasn't an issue for them. This is 2005, 2006. And it's before America, it's before it's really spread. It's only been, I think, in the Netherlands and Norway, or countries like that previously. And he wins, he persuades the public that this really is important, and that it's a matter of justice to people who are homosexual. And he uses, in fact, a test that I talk about as a core Republican test, which is you're free when you can look others in the eye without reason for fear or deference. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're protected enough by law and by position that you don't have to defer, to kowtow, to bow to anyone else. And he uses that in Parliament, you know, in saying, which of you can leave this house and expect a homosexual to look you in the eye when you've voted that their intimate relations are not worthy of the same civic legal recognition as heterosexual marriage. And that was really persuasive for, I think, people in general, but also for his own party.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Just interested in, you know, you talked about like a government having a philosophy by which they apply all of their policies and laws and changing their legislation, etc. In Ireland, we're a republic. We call ourselves the Republic of Ireland. To what extent do we hold ourselves accountable in terms of acting as a republic? And what does it mean to be a republic? So, of course, we're here to discuss the work of Thomas Hobbes, and it specifically...
A great enemy, of course, of republican theory in his time.
Absolutely. You know, but this is because he's one of the 16 key thinkers on this politics and society course, and we'll have a lot of young listeners listening in who mightn't have thought, I suppose, about the term republic and what that means. But can you kind of give us a little bit about what that term actually means? It has a, there's a criteria that one should fulfill in order to be a Republican?
I think of that there are three sort of tests that any society needs to meet if it's going to count as a republic, in the sense that appeared really with classical Rome. You know, that's the original. I mean, it was a very imperfect society, but it gave rise to these three ideas. And the ideas are, first of all, an idea of freedom. That to be free, it's not enough to be just let alone, you know, to be not interfered with. I mean, I often give the example of, you know, Nora and Torvald, the husband and wife in a doll's house. Torvald has all the power, legally and so on, over Nora. But he's very nice to Nora. He dotes on her, you know, worships the ground she walks on. So Nora can really do as she likes, right? Because Torvald allows her. So I often ask, is Nora free? Well, in the Republican way of thinking, she's not free, because she depends on Torvald's will remaining a good will. She's got carte blanche, you know, she's got laissez-faire, she's got sort of liberal freedom, if you like, but she doesn't have freedom in the sense that requires power, you know, that you're not stood over by another. So that's the first idea, that that what a republic should aim at is ensuring that its subjects, I should say its citizens, because they're not really subjects, that its citizens can walk tall, look others in the eye without reason for fear or deference. In other words, have this not being stood over by others. That's the first thing. And that requires, of course, a protective law, but it also requires laws that empower people who have disabilities, who have various vulnerabilities, who are weak in various ways. It requires economic support for the weaker. It requires constraints on the very powerful and what they can do. But that's the first idea. Freedom, as I call it, freedom as non-domination, meaning you're not dominated or stood over by anybody else. Second idea is that in order to get this, you have to have a state in which there are, well, for example, there's a separate judiciary. It's very important that there are different parts to the polity or the state which are independent of one another. That's the main divide between judiciary and the legislature and the executive, the other parts of government. They called it in the old days the mixed constitution, you know, rather than having power in one set of hands. And you see, someone like Hobbes, we'll talk about in a moment, Hobbes is exactly the opposite of that. He thinks a state to be effective has to have absolute power in one set of hands, ideally in the hands of one person, a king, though he'll admit it'd be fine if it were even just one body, like a parliament, or indeed a committee of the whole, like everybody, so long as it's just one body that makes the laws, no sort of checks and balances with an independent judiciary. Second idea, though, in the Republican tradition, you absolutely need to, power needs to be held in distinct hands that check and balance one another. And the third idea is that in order to have a regime, a mixed constitution, in which people enjoy this sort of freedom as non-domination against one another and against their rulers, it has to be the case that people play an active role in controlling how their state operates, how those in government operate. So that involves, obviously, elections, which were, you know, very much a part of ancient Rome, for example, who was quite democratic in many ways, that people are involved in electing those who will rule them. That's very important. But what's equally important is that people are able to challenge those in power, in the courts, in the media, on the streets. It's anti-sort of populist as well as anti-absolutist. It shouldn't be the case that there's just one leader representing the people, so-called. That's a nationalism or populism. No, no, power is separated out. That's the second idea. And part of the separation is that people can get involved as protesters as well as electors.
So that is the idea of a republic.
That's the idea of a republic. So freedom is non-domination for all. A mixed constitution, different bodies in the government, you know, checking and balancing one another. And thirdly, a citizenry that are contestatory. You know, they're able and willing to contest what government is doing, both at election time, but also in between elections, in active social and civic groups, I would say. So, for example, having a women's movement, having a prisoners' rights movement, having a consumers' movement, having a health consumers' movement, all of these really important, having an environmental movement that will keep tabs on government and talk out, you know, against government mm-hmm. and challenge government, and mount, you know, challenge, not just parliamentary through opposition, but if in the in the streets, in the courts, in the media.
Yes. And to what extent do you think that Ireland is fulfilling this? Has it, does it, I assume it wavers over the years. I mean, with governments, various changes in politicians and different political thought, that, and even economically, if there's an economic change, I guess the government responds to that then in one sense. So do you think we have changed in terms of our commitment to republicanism, or are we doing okay?
I think we're doing a lot better than a lot of other countries, that's for sure, mm-hmm. you know, particularly in Europe. If you look mm-hmm. at what's happening in Hungary or in Poland, they're all moving towards a don't have the mixed constitution, same in Russia, mm-hmm. same in Turkey. They break up the independence of the judiciary, that's the first thing, you know, mm-hmm. or the independence of different parts of government. So there are powers in one hand, Putin's hand or Erdogan's hand or Orban's hands, right? Ireland, of course, is much, much better than that, obviously. But equally, in those countries, there's been a suppression of civic movements. They call them foreign agents and claim they're all funded from outside the country. Mm-hmm. That's, again, anathema to the Republican ideas. Ireland does very well on that. I mean, you know, it's hard. I haven't thought about this at length, but I would have said that two of the problems Ireland has had in the past are, first of all, cronyism. It's a small country, and that's always the danger of the small country, that those in government are going to be, you know, just too close to with those with economic power in business, etc., etc., can do mm-hmm. deals, backroom deals. Very hard to maintain a real transparency, you know, so that ordinary people know what's going on. On the other hand, Ireland's been very good at the tribunals that we've had over many, many tribunals over many years. And that's all been, it's letting in the sunlight, you know, mm-hmm. and it's putting out a warning there for, you know, this cronyism will, it may not show up in the years you benefit from, the first five, but 10, 15 years it will, you know. I mean, in the other aspect, of course, you have to say, is the power of the church in Ireland is anathema to republicanism. I mean, the power that it has had. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, the history bears it out that there were backroom deals done between the church, if only, you know, at the worst end, in the police not following up, you know, mm-hmm. where they really knew there was abuse going on mm-hmm. because priests were involved or the church was involved, and that was basically a territory you didn't enter. So the church has been, I would say, in that sense, a problem for Republican government. But again, that's improved also a lot. Now, the problems Ireland has, I mean, I get very angry about the Eurozone because I think that that did involve a sort of expatriation, you know, of control that we didn't really realise, I think, what we were buying into with the Eurozone and how the Eurozone treated Ireland in 2008 to 11, you know, in that period, is really a shocker, you know.
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that, you know, they basically forced Ireland to nationalise the banks. That meant that the Irish taxpayer, I mean, to buy up the bonds and support the banks, that meant that the Irish taxpayer basically bought the bonds, which are held mainly by French and German banks, as we know. Those people who had bought those bonds are essentially you take a risk when you buy a bond, mm-hmm. and you should have to wear the risk if the risk doesn't work out to your satisfaction. Those people should have had to bear the risk of various bank failures in Ireland. Instead, the Eurozone, the central bank, the European Central Bank, basically forced the Irish government to say, no, no, we'll buy up all the bonds, that's essentially what they did, save all those people all over the world, the bondholders, and the Irish taxpayer will pick up the tab.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a shocker, you know. Mm-hmm. The behaviour of the Central European Bank is really it's really beyond belief. I mean, a central bank is supposed to be an organ whereby you support banks when they're in trouble, but here it is basically forcing a particular government of the Eurozone to put all the debt onto its own. Citizens. I mean, that was really a shocking abuse of power. And I think there's not enough outrage in Ireland mm-hmm. about that. I found it extraordinary that people have gone along. I mean, in 2008, the national debt in Ireland was 25% of GDP. It was very low, much lower than Germany, much lower than Britain, much lower than most places in Europe, ironically, except Spain, which was also quite good at that time. Mm-hmm. Now it's about 125% for GDP. God. And that's a debt that Irish taxpayers, you know, my family, your family, my nieces and nephews and their children
and
are going to be paying
off. And many of the
people
who are listening to this podcast. Yeah.
Exactly. They're going to be paying that off for the next 50 years. You know, I mean, it'll ease very quickly with inflation and that sort of thing. But still, that should never have happened. Mm-mm. On the other hand, I have to say one thing. A republic should play ball with other countries. So one of the things that really embarrasses me as an Irish person is the corporate tax level. Because it's insane that countries would be played off against one another by corporations. You know, we move here unless you lower our tax rate. And, mm-hmm. and of course, what's happening, you know, is that tax rates are coming down everywhere. That means ordinary people suffer. And these multinational corporations, they're the ones who benefit. And, you know, I have to say, it's understandable why the government of the day, you know, would have looked for the advantage that goes with the lower tax rate and so on. And it's hard to condemn, and I don't really mean to condemn, but it is really a shocker and it's embarrassing that Ireland was the one who, in a way, set that ball, you know, the downward spiral mm-hmm. going, you know, by cutting its tax rate way back
setting
to 12.5%.
Setting the precedent in terms of...
Yes, of course. Other countries are going to. It was small enough for people not to follow it, but now with the Eastern European countries in the EU and so on, and of course with Brexit and Britain threatening to reduce it, and of course Trump in America, I mean, maybe it would have happened anyhow, mm-hmm. but it's sort of a bit of a shame that Ireland led the way in that downward spiral.
Yes. What would Thomas Hobbes have to say about it all? So Thomas Hobbes, I guess, is the whole reason we're here today to start... So we were just about to discuss Thomas Hobbes. So 1588 to 1679, I mean, we're talking a man who lived hundreds of years ago and still his work is so influential and such a part of political philosophy today. I guess he was considered one of the founding fathers of modern political philosophy. And is it fair to say that he was driven by the question, how can human beings live peacefully together?
Well, I think actually he was... that's certainly a very important strand in his thought. But his main aim, and he really was marvellously successful in this aim, was to give people a sense of, his particular sense of, you might reject it, of why a state was necessary. Now, you must remember about Hobbes, he did live at a time after the Reformation when there were religious wars all over Europe. I mean, the 30 Years' War in France and Germany between Protestant and Catholic, you know, has really wreaked devastation in Europe. And in England itself, of course, there's the debate between the war between Parliament and the King. So at that time, it's sort of understandable that he'd say, what we really need, above all else, is a state that will bring peace, as you say, that will enable people to live at peace with one another.
And have a stable society.
Yes.
So he was interested in how people would organise themselves and have some kind of a contract, I suppose, that would ensure that would be maintained.
Right. Now, looking back historically, you can probably feel that, you know, what he was doing was treating the world he lived in, where there was this, I mean, people were killing one another because of their beliefs, you know. He treats that world he's living in, which is a very tumultuous, you know, strife-ridden world, a warlike world, as if that's how human beings will always be unless they've got a really strong state that will suppress all sorts of civil strife.
So discipline. And he needed there to be discipline overruling.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think he goes too far in the sense that I don't think people naturally end up in civil war unless there's a very strong state. But he argues, generalizing from his own experience of his period, I would say, that that's really the natural state of human beings. And he calls it the state of nature. Mm-hmm. And as he says famously about it, in the state of nature, without a strong state, you know, to impose the peace. Life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. You know, one of the great sort of five words in the canon of political theory. Life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. The idea is that people are at loggerheads all the time, terribly sort of envious of one another, watching one another, the advantage they seek, stealing from one another, being prepared to challenge one another. And he even says that actually, if there were no state, you couldn't blame them for doing this. As he puts it, it's their natural right, each to defend himself or herself or their families and so on against others at whatever cost. So he has this image of a war of all against all is what you get unless you've got a state. And then, of course, his next question is, well, wait a moment, how would a state come about? I mean, of course, you might imagine, well, the state might come about by someone, a strong guy, you know, with a private army coming in like a mafia boss and imposing order on them. Mm. Would that do it? Well, of course, the anarchy of the state of nature is bad for Hobbes, but he also reckons that most people are going to see that the tyranny of someone coming in and just imposing on them is also not going to be very attractive. Mm-hmm. So he tells a story under which the state that will impose the peace will almost always come about in a way that involves the consent of people living under the state. So he says, well, here's how it would come about ideally. And ideally, he imagines people coming together in a sort of assembly and recognizing they've got a problem, they're all fighting one another, and then agreeing that they will make some one individual boss, mm-hmm. or maybe make some committee boss, even themselves, as mm-hmm. I said, the committee of the whole boss. But there'll be one boss, mm-hmm. and that boss will lay down the law, impose the law, there'll be no separation between judiciary and that he's, she, it, they.
They have the final say, and that is it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They're going to be in charge of everything. That's the ideal, so you'd contract into having a sovereign, as the word he uses. It becomes the great word. A sovereign body, sovereign individual. But he also argues that even in the case where, let's say, a conqueror comes into a country and takes over, and people submit to the sovereign, you know, on pain of having their head cut off, he suggests that even then, you can see that people are implicitly actually contracting into being ruled by him. Because, and now I think this is pretty dishonest on Hobbes's part, he says, after all, if someone is holding a sword over your head and says, am I the boss or am I not? Am I the sovereign, right? And you say, yes, boss, yes, you're the sovereign, right? Hobbes says, well, you may have done that out of fear, but you weren't actually physically forced to do it, you know?
Right.
And you actually did it because it suited your desires, including your fear of your own life. So you agreed, didn't you? And he says this is a voluntary act on your part. But and now this is maybe a subtle philosophical point, but there is a big difference between doing something out of desire, we say doing it intentionally, and doing it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if the robber comes along to you, you're walking in Central Park, say, in New York, and says, give me your purse, right, or I shoot you, you know, with a gun. If you give the robber your purse, then you do it intentionally, you know, out of fear, for sure, you do it intentionally. But none of us would say you did it voluntarily. In order to do it voluntarily, it has to be the case not just that you do it because of what you desire, that's true in the robber case too, but it also has to be the case that you had a choice between doing that and doing something else, where the something else is also perfectly acceptable. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have that choice in the park example. You either give him the money or you die, he shoots you, right? But that means that there wasn't an acceptable alternative to giving the money, so while you gave it out of your desires or intentionally, you didn't give it voluntarily, mm-hmm. you know? You had no choice but to give it, given the alternative was so bad.
Yes.
Now, similarly, if you subject yourself to submit to the conqueror, you know, you may do it intentionally, but you don't do it voluntarily mm-hmm. because he cuts your head off.
Yes.
Unless, and Hobbes, the sort of centerpiece of Hobbes's philosophy involves an ambiguity in this. He says, You did it intentionally and therefore voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And therefore, even when there isn't a formal contract, like in the ideal case that I talked about, we can all see ourselves as submitting to someone who's capable of imposing the peace. Mm-hmm. And he says submitting voluntarily to that person. Mm-hmm. That's just rubbish, let's face it, you know. Yes. But it was a very powerful defense of having a state that was as strong as he wanted it to be.
Yes. And to what extent do citizens have the ability then to engage with that in his conception of what a sovereign is? It's a total absolutism that the sovereign has all of the power. So there's no democracy, there's no engaging with that?
Well, no, this now is important. He says that you need a single pair of hands, because if you're an independent judiciary, you know, one would be mm-hmm. rubbing off against the other, you know, and you wouldn't really have a single will that's imposed on people, a single law, mm-hmm. you know, because the lawgiver wouldn't know how the courts would interpret a law mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. So he says what's important is a single set of hands, but, and this is the difference now, that set of hands can be an individual. And that's what he actually thought was the best way. So he wanted the King of England, or the King of France, to be an absolute king, mm-hmm. above the law, above everybody else, mm-hmm. And capable of just ruling at will over his or her subjects. Mm-hmm. He admits, though, at least in theory, it could be a committee. You know, it might be a committee, an elite, mm-hmm. a committee of the few. Mm-hmm. And they make all the decisions, and they rule. That would work in theory. And he admits it would even work in theory. He doesn't think it would work in practice. It would even work in theory if everybody came together and voted up every decision. So it's a plenary committee, right. Rather than an elite mm-hmm. committee. It's a populist committee, mm-hmm. a populist committee. Now, the really interesting thing is that Rousseau, who mm-hmm. follows 100 years later, he basically says, look, yes, you have to have an absolute power like this. It's unfortunate that he claimed to be a Republican, because he has freedom as non-domination, but he drops the mixed constitution aspect mm-hmm. and indeed the contestatory citizenry aspect of republicanism. Mm-hmm. Rousseau says there has to be a single, like Hobbes, there has to be a single sovereign, but he says it has to be all of the people, you
right.
know,
okay.
who meet regularly to vote on. Of course, that means only a small state can be like Geneva, which is mm-hmm. where he's from, can really be, and he only means men, unfortunately, mm-hmm. at the time. It's only masculinist culture. But he thinks everyone should be involved. Not every day, but they meet at regular intervals, they lay down the law, and they appoint the people who will then enact the law. Now, populism nowadays, of the kind that Putin represents, you know, people call it autarchical democracy, is actually very like Hobbes's image of democracy, mm-hmm. which is very striking. You know, they're really looking for absolute government. Of course, they don't want all the people involved in voting, but they want to be elected, and they mm-hmm. claim then to represent the nation, to incarnate the nation. But it's the same Hobbesian thought. You know, you need a single power in the land.
Right. So even if people didn't agree with his conception, and I'm sure even plenty of our listeners might find a lot of issue with his political thought, but the reason why he's so important is because he was kind of the first person who really like pushed this idea forward. So anybody who came after that used him as the person to go to in terms of if they were criticizing or they were agreeing with. So he's kind of the person that the conversation revolves around in terms
absolutely,
of...
Absolutely. Very few people claim to agree with him, because mm-hmm. he's become, say, a notorious figure. Mm-hmm. Partly because of his mm-hmm. views, and his views on other matters too. And he was clearly... Well, I think he was clearly an atheist, though he doesn't.
Yes.
He writes as if he isn't. Mm-hmm. And at the time, that would have made him, you know, verboten, a sort of anathema.
It would have been illegal
to,
at the time, was it, to be an atheist within England?
Gosh, I can't tell you the strict law. Almost certainly, I think. It may not... I just don't know the law.
Yes, yeah. But it certainly
England,
wouldn't have been like being an atheist in this day and age.
No,
it would have had severe consequences.
Very severe consequences. Mm-hmm. So he was a bad name. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at someone like Rousseau, who claims to disagree with Hobbes, an awful lot of Rousseau is really Hobbesian, including the idea it's a popular sovereign, you know? Mm-hmm. The idea of popular sovereignty mm-hmm. comes from Hobbes, you know, via Rousseau to us. Mm-hmm. It's of course, gets thinned out because it's no longer a participatory assembly, but a representative assembly, and then becomes, of course, usually one man who's in charge, or a woman, it could be, of that assembly. That's the Putin, or that's the Orban, or that's the Erdogan. And, of course, people in that position are always attracted to this, you know, because after all, power corrupts, you know, and it's extremely attractive. But they're really following, whether they realise it or not, in Hobbes's footsteps, whereas the opposition, the Republican opposition, I mean, Hobbes himself saw his opponents really as the Republicans. The mixed constitution is his absolutely, is his central enemy. So, for example, he's happy with, he's the first one really, well, following Baudin, a French thinker shortly before, but he's really one of the first people who uses the word democracy to mean this voting multiplicity, you know, the voting sort of majority of people as a whole. Before that, democracy didn't really have a very exact meaning, but it would have applied to a republic just as well, even though there was a separation of powers. Now, that's what his real bête noire is, you know, that's what his real enemy is.
Very good. Professor Philip Pettit, it has been an absolute pleasure to be your guest here in your home this afternoon. I just want to say thank you so very, very much for taking part in the podcast. If you, just to end the podcast, do you have any advice for any aspiring philosophers out there who might, you know, already have some great ideas and not be sure how to get them out there, or not sure how to kind of carry on their path and develop their thought? What would your advice be?
Well, that's a difficult question, isn't it? I mean, these people, teenagers and so on that we're thinking of, younger people, they're going to be reading, presumably, these texts, like parts of Leviathan, Hobbes's great text, or some of the other texts. I would say, if there was one word, I would say this: try to become a native in the land rather than a tourist. You know, tourist reading, you know, your tourist goes to a country, he sort of sees all the spots, he remembers them, he takes photographs, he writes letters maybe, or what, or emails about it. But he never really gets inside the culture, you know, doesn't really know how it ticks, doesn't go native. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're reading someone like Hobbes, it's very easy. It's quite difficult because he's writing 17th century English and it takes time. But I think it's more important to really try to think, if I were Hobbes and I was dealing with these problems, I really thought that dissension, civil strife, was the main problem. I really thought that that you needed a single powerful government, that mixing, separating powers, like in the mixed constitution, was a bad thought. How would I think about the state? And that way you really get inside Hobbes's world, you know, you begin to think like Hobbes. You say, okay, that's why he does this, you know, that's why he does that. So, you know, you can see why the state of nature appealed to him, you know, arguing with others that if you haven't a state, you've just got the state of nature.
Yes.
And, of course, using, he thinks, he calls them the savages of North America, you know, live, he thinks, in a state of nature.
And those would be Native American Indians who's
Yes, he's talking about American Indians. He's wrong, of course, about them, but he feels that this, you know, he can make a case for this claim that people without the state are going to enter into a war of all against all. So we really need the state. That's his first. And then secondly, what sort of state would solve, if that is the real problem, that people are always going to look for advantage, always going to suppress others, what sort of state do you need? And of course, you can see why Hobbes might think, oh God, if you have an independent judiciary, you know, they'll all be constantly bickering at one another, you know, there'll be different interpretations of the law, there'll be people bringing complaints. It'll be a mess. So, you see, Hobbes is led to think, no, you've got to have a single power in one hand. That's my advice, to try to go native by actually thinking about the problem.
Get under the skin of it. And
under the skin of it.
Feel at home. Don't feel like you're... Yeah, that's fantastic.
It means putting yourself back in time to their concerns, you know?
Yes. Thank you so much. I think that's an absolutely fantastic piece of advice and a really lovely way to finish the podcast for today. So once again, Professor Philip Pettit, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Just hold on, Ron. I'm in a hurry because I have to wait for him in here.
Did you get an Uber, was it?
No. Jesus. up, actually.